Yeah, Ate, Keshi, Ola, hello and welcome to everyone tonight. We're honored to have David Sloan this evening here to speak to us and share his experiences as one of the most famous Native American architects in the country. Before I introduce him, I would like to thank the people who made his visit possible. This day, during which we visited classes and met with students, this could not have happened without John Vilson White. Great support has also been provided by the Arts and Sciences Division, chaired by Kathy Head, and the administrative staff, Erlinda Torres and Tiffany Yazzie. Ryan Whitman helped with the banners, and Carmen Wellborn and Marilee Petranovich were crucial to publicizing this event. I'd also like to thank the building maintenance and physical plant staff, Ron Petranovich, Abby Montoya, Andrew Tikala, and David Gonzalez. And thank you to Joe Elliott Nez for helping us out tonight with the technology aspect of this. The funding for Mr. Sloan's visit was provided by a mini-grant, and I'd like to extend my appreciation also to the mini-grant committee headed by Alok Dittal. David Sloan was born in Rehoboth and grew up in Utah and in Flagstaff. He attended college in California and graduated with a Bachelor's of Fine Arts with a concentration in architecture from the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He interned with several different architectural firms and, after taking his boards, opened his own office in 1985. Mr. Sloan has contributed to the designs of some very high-profile architecture, including the Bosque Redondo Memorial in Fort Sumner and the Cultural Resources Center of the National Museum of the American Indian in Suitland, Maryland. But most of you see his work every day, even though you might not be aware of it. As you pass the Navajo Nation Tech Innovation Incubator on I-40, just east of Gallup here, or the Navajo Tribal Utility Authority in Crown Point, or the Navajo Housing Authority Office Addition in Fort Defiance. He's the most noted Dene architect of our time, and please join me in giving a warm welcome to David Sloan.
Tuaglini is my clan and my born for mini goats, Klizlana. And what you see up there on the screen is a drawing sketch done by one of my relatives from Lake Valley. It was for a family gathering some years ago. In the image up to the right is Marble Canyon up by the western part of Navajo Reservation, and that's where my father, his family's from that area. And the image on your lower left here is Chaco Canyon. You can't see it clearly, but there's a little cemetery in Chaco Canyon. My grandmother, Grace Itzitti, is buried there. And her father, uncles, and relatives, you know, they kind of grew up around the Chaco area on the west boundary of the Park Service. And this other image is on the highway going up towards Page, Arizona. This is a City Ridge area. And that's where I spent a lot of my youth growing up in the western part of Navajo Reservation. My family is a large family, a lot of brothers and sisters. Common probably with a lot of Navajo families back then, you know, in the 50s and 60s. Part of the years that I grew up was very undeveloped. I remember a lot of the highways, like one from Tuba City up towards Shiprock. It was just all gravel roads. At the time, back in the early 60s, is when they started building the dam in Page. And there was like a lot of construction going on when I was growing up. My parents, my father, did a lot of construction work early on, and also my older brothers. So a lot of the early experience I had was being around construction and being encouraged by my father to find a job in construction, kind of led my interest towards working in that kind of a field. But the other thing too is growing up, back then they had this, what they call the border town dormitories. And so I went to school in Flagstaff, at the border town dormitory there in Flagstaff. Totally different program for Navajo kids to go out to the school system locally that's non-Navajo. So that was kind of like the early experience of my education, was going through the boarding school. And then when I got through with high school, I went to another program called the BIA Relocation Program. And again, the whole effort was to take the Indian kids off the reservation, you know, put them in mainstream society and make their way through life, you know, get on moving away from the reservation. So anyway, I ended up in San Francisco, California, back in the late 60s. Probably most of you don't know, but you know, the different generation at different times. In the 60s, there was like a lot of changes and a lot of activity about equality and about changing government. But anyway, my early years in school was going through a community college system in California. California had a great program for community colleges at that time. They were combining vocational training with a kind of like a formal education. The whole concept was, you know, besides you being a good carpenter, we want you to be a good citizen. So that was kind of like my early experience becoming, gaining the confidence, you know, to be successful in school, because, you know, I wasn't really paying attention to education in high school. I had other things on my mind, other thoughts. But I made it through and got a degree in architecture from University of New Mexico back in 75. But going through that process of education, my initial thoughts were about becoming a carpenter and using my hands and then working to build the community, because that was the most of you probably are encouraged by your parents, grandparents, you know, to build, be part of that community. It's the same lessons that I learned. And so going through that educational process, one of the things that I was exposed to and really got interested in was, besides art, was philosophy. And really trying to understand, you know, about the way of life and the way of life of Native people, and really trying to understand what is the values that you have and how do you express it. So looking at my education, I thought about art, But I also was very good in math and science. And then just naturally combining art and science, architecture, for me was the choice that I made. Over time, with my practice, I've had like a lot of opportunities working with Native communities, predominantly through the federal government. The federal government, when they first started the flow of money to the Navajo Reservation, was back in the late 60s and early 70s. They started providing money not only for education, but for housing, for community development. And the same thing with the federal programs that I was fortunate enough to work with. We started working with school projects. We started working with healthcare centers. So I had a chance not only to work in the Southwest, but working back east in some of the communities there and up into the north, into North Dakota, Montana, and all over to Washington. But predominantly what I started out doing was mostly renovations of existing buildings, schools, healthcare centers, hospitals. That was my first kind of projects that I was doing. And not only working with the Navajo people, but also the people in the Southwest and other tribes across the country. But every place I visit, I always went back to trying to understand what it was that they were trying to define as Native American architecture. Because most of the buildings and facilities that were built on reservations were predominantly the models and the building types that you often see in the cities. There was no really local type of architecture. So when I started out, I wanted to kind of get a feel for what it is that they start talking about Native American architecture. And starting out, you look at the different regions and you look at the different building materials. Then you start looking at the structures that people use to build their own shelter. And whether it's wood, stone, mud, the plants, these are all part of the building materials that they use locally. And the craftsmen, the builders, they saw what was predominantly the building forms, whether it was the nature, or whether it was the livestock. And so I started looking at what made these building forms, the way they were shaped and how they were formed. And visiting these communities and asking them, okay, what it is that makes you think about the form and the shape. And it always came back to oral history, storytelling, you know, about creation or talking about the way of life. And the way of life, it came back to me, is like philosophy. You know, one of my original ideas when I started going through education was, you know, what is that? You know, because my upbringing, I really didn't have a traditional teachings from home. My parents were traveling, looking for work. You know, so I was searching for that. But I also had a chance to work with a lot of different tribal communities, especially in the Southwest. And the same thing is the building materials, the forms, and the shape. and the structures and the different purposes that they had in building that space. That was what I was looking for as I began to search out the idea about Native American architecture. What it really came down to was the way of life and a lot of the storytelling that the people had about that way of life was based upon their perception of the landscape in that relationship that they had with that landscape was the recurring stories that I continually heard from Native communities, Native people, from the Southwest to the Northeast to the Northwest and then the Plains. They would describe, you know, their landscape and their history based upon landmarks in the area, significant events by the river, in the mountains, in the forest. They would have different stories about that. And with those stories, the inside of a building, whether it's a communal building, a worship space, or even a family space, it was kind of described in the same manner of that relationship to the land. So early on, that's what we started to focus on. And some of the people I worked with in the Northwest, Northwest, we're building a clinic up in the north of Seattle. And the river was the main transportation line, the main communication lines, all the activity along the river. And they would have their songs and their prayers expressing that. And that's what we started to take a good look at in trying to define Native American architecture. But at the same time, some of the early, this is a building up in Haskell University. This is down in San Javier by Tucson. And then this is in Pecon College in Muskogee, Oklahoma, where we did a community student center for Pecon College. And Pecon College was the first Native university in the country. And it was like a melting pot there, too. A lot of different students coming from a lot of different reservations. And, of course, you know the Navajo capital. But all of these were like buildings in transition from, you know, the Native building types, the Native forms, the Native shapes. And then now today, it's really changing for us. Technology. You know, a lot of times I'll go to a lot of housing projects because we've done like a lot of housing construction. And I will walk through homes and I'll visit with the families in the homes and find out what's going on with their house. You know, how's it working? But you see in a lot of these homes now, a lot of technology inside that home, and a lot of that technology is connected to the internet and to everything beyond that. So young kids are really learning about life very fast and structure-wise. It's hard to get the focus. I did a job up in Portland, Oregon, with the Portland Student Center. And again, there were students from all over the country come into Portland, you know, for their education. And then working in the Midwest. But here is where I try to put things down on paper. Try to define a method or a process. You know, how do you go about designing a building with a native perspective, a native approach? I can't say it's unique or it's different, but it's the way that I'm able to communicate, okay, to the community, the client, about how we can go through a process of design that identifies the need, that identifies the space, the landscape, and then how that is folded into the design. Here is where I really look at community and whether this is a Navajo Nation or Hopi or in the Midwest. You know, it's their landscape, it's their environment, it's their climate, it's their stories. Those are all part of that process. And a lot of times what I do is provide the visual images of those spaces and that time. Because once you start visually giving them clues about that past, they'll start talking about what their ideas are, what their vision is about that space or about that need for a building. And that's how you really begin to build the foundation on that design. And here is a lot of the interpretations that you make of what you hear from the community, as well as what you see and feel from that community. And those interpretations, a lot of times we have to deal with a lot of code information, a lot of details related, public health, safety, that sort of stuff. You have to kind of combine that with the community ideas. But at the same time, you want to make those interpretations so that visually you can be creative and show it to the community and get that feedback. And here is where we talk about translation. Translation into an actual plan, into an actual drawing, and then come back to the final product. But this was my first attempt at putting it down on paper. But I have like a lot of other visuals that supports that whole step and that whole process. Okay, one of the things from experience that kind of really pushed me about opening my own office. I was working for a company in Albuquerque that was doing projects for the Navajo people. And they had a difficult time, okay, understanding the landscape, understanding the history of the people, and understanding some of the ideas that the people had about their own needs and their own ideas about helping themselves.
But one of the things
that was important to me in this process was problem solving, decision making, and consensus building.
These are just samples, again,
of some of the projects I've done. And I really get into looking at the materials, like native materials, and then the craftsmanship that went into forming those materials. And the whole idea is that once you define some of the cultural images, it reinforces back to the people who are using those buildings, reinforces their identity in that building and in that space. So we're constantly looking for ways of making that interpretation and translating that into a building space. So a lot of times when a person talks their stories about the elders and about the rains that would come, and they would talk about the plants that they harvest and about how they would care for the livestock, those were some of the things that we would try to integrate into that building design. This here is the health center in Isleta, Pueblo. And we did some community recreation centers down in Tohono O'odham. We did a store up in Dulce, Jicarilla Apaches with the timber. And we did some projects over in Prescott with the Yavapai Apache. And then here we did a project with the elders in Laguna. And basically, it's us. When I say us, myself and my staff, which is predominantly Navajo, sitting down and drawing by hand the ideas or the images that they were expressing, and we keep showing it back to them, you know, and then hearing more stories about it. Lillian is too generous when she says famous. I'm working at, you know, making a living. I'm working at really being a community member and helping with that community as it grows and develops. And that was kind of like my main reason for going into architecture. This is in Crown Point. That was one of the first jobs that we did in 88. And again, you know, borrowing from the area with the stone, and then looking at your mom's, your aunt's, you know, their weaving patterns, and trying to express that in the form. So the whole idea was, you know, what is welcoming, you know, to the people. And that was the first job that we've done. But I also had a chance to work on a pavilion up in Salt Lake City during the 2002 Winter Olympics. And we put a lot of work into this project. We started back in 2001 in the fall. And unfortunately, 2001, 9/11 followed that. So it kind of changed things for us, but it allowed us to have visitors, you know, internationally come and be exposed. Navajo Nation spent quite a bit of money doing this exhibit. Then another project that I was very fortunate to be involved in is that National Museum for the American Indian. Museum for the American Indian in Washington, D.C. is actually three physical locations. Back in the 1850s, there was a collector living in New York City who would travel the Western Hemisphere, and he would buy all kinds of materials, everything from blankets, pottery, arts and crafts, silverware, everything. And he had that collection in New York City. And this is the what they call the old custom house in Lower Manhattan in New York City. And that's one of the exhibit halls for the National Museum for the American Indian. Then here is the project I worked on. It's called the Cultural Resource Center in Suitland, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. And I traveled back to Manhattan for 7 months working with the architects and developing that plan for this project. They had collections from all over the country. They had materials from Navajo, from Hopi, from the Eastern Coast to the West Coast. And this collection had to be conserved, protected. So there was like a lot of work in that material and preserving it. And then understanding the history of that collection, those materials. So a lot of it had to be classified. But at the same time, they sent us out to a lot of these tribal communities and asking them, okay, what are your ideas about having your materials in New York City? And a lot of this material is going to go back to the native communities, because some of those materials, you know, are, I don't say sacred, but they were materials that were part of that community, and they give that community identity. So a lot of that material is going back. But what we try to do here in this project, it was just outside of Washington, D.C., and there's like the fourth generation of that landscape, meaning that it was by the freeway. It probably was one time a open field, a meadow, and then it was a farmland. Then from farmland, it went back to open field. So it was like different generations of nature happening there. And one of the first things that we did was we looked at, well, what does that mean, that landscape? And what does that mean hosting the building? So it was kind of like a constant struggle, arm wrestling, and movement. So the whole idea was it was twisting, it was turning. And that roof line was part of the giving peace to that place. At the same time, storing all of those materials. In inside, there are spaces, different levels of different materials from different parts of the Western Hemisphere. Each part had its own space, its own identity. That was all part of the planning. And here, this is the museum on the Mall in Washington, D.C. A Canadian native architect was the architect for that project. And then there was another native landscape architect from Seattle who did all of the landscape outside the building. And if you get a chance to visit, you'll see that he tried to bring back the natural environment to that space. But a lot of my work is collaboration. I work with a lot of other architects, native architects, and doing projects, and non-native architects as well, and doing projects for native communities. This is that project I was telling you in Portland, Oregon, Portland University Student Center. And there, we also work with a lot of the native students in the native community in Portland. As you know, what's really popular is song and dance, and even with powwows. You know, back when I was growing up, powwows to me was like Flagstaff powwow, where it was all Navajo and a few Apaches and so forth. But these days, it's all integrated. You know, we're intertribal now. There's a lot of tribes have intermarried. A lot of tribes have different thoughts about who they are by that intermarriage. So this project was sort of like that. We had a lot of different ideas, but students coming from the Midwest about what they were familiar with, you know, in their communities, with poles, with timber, and then we had the local coastal tribes, you know, being there too with their ideas about water life, about the sea. And that's what the outcome is. This year was, like I was telling you, I did some work with the National Park Service. This is Great Sands in southern Colorado. This was significant for me because it's right below Blanca Peak. And when I went to the site, Blanca Peak, you know, being like the gateway to the east, and trying to visualize, you know, what the Navajo people would have been looking out towards the east, and why would they make that a landmark? And then doing that project in that same foothills. And this is another project I did with another architect from Portland. And that was with the Gila River Indian community. And there, it's the, you saw the earlier pictures of the, here, this space and this space here. And you take those kind of forms and ideas and you start doing that design. And they had what they call playing fields, great plazas. And this was the Elder Center at Tohono O'odham. And the whole idea was the whole Tohono O'odham Nation had all of their elders, you know, housed at nursing homes off of the reservation. And then being able to bring those elders back to the reservation. And the stories that a lot of the elders expressed as we were doing the project gave us a lot of inspiration in doing that design of that building. And right now, I've been working on two new shopping centers. One's over in Burnside, in Bacanato, and the other one's in Sanders. But this is kind of like the projects I've been able to work on. Like this is in Pinon, Wonder Rock, Navajo, New Mexico, and then over in Pinedale, by Rima, of course, Wonder Rock. Then we did a project for the Hickory Apaches up in Dulce. So a lot of the work that I've been doing for tribal people is really spending the time and the effort of hearing the stories and becoming familiar with the landscape and really understanding, you know, how to draw out and listen to what people were telling us. Bosque Redon, been very fortunate to work with the state of New Mexico on this project. I know there's like a lot of different opinions about, you know, whether or not an appropriate response was to build a visitor center at that location and of that past history. But one of the early individuals I met was from Fort Sumner. He was a school principal, teacher, later became the mayor, and then he also became an advocate for the project. And the whole idea was talking about tolerance, equality. So to me, that was like my guiding light, you know, in undertaking the project. Because there's a lot of lessons to still have to be learned. There's still a lot of events that we have to overcome in making a better community for all cultures. And these are slides that kind of run through where general background, okay, on the project. Of course, Navajo Nation, Four Corners, and all the different landmarks within that environment. And then beginning to, when you hear stories by Navajo people expressing their different ideas, their different opinions, then you start trying to draw like an overlay of what that represents. What does that mean? Working with the state of New Mexico too, they have all the archives, a lot of photographs of the Navajo people back then, as well as the changes on the reservations, especially in northeast, northwest New Mexico. My mother's family, they had land allotments. And when I started doing this project, my mother passed away, so those land allotments, that assignment came to my brothers and sisters, myself, and those land allotments, it described the different families and the relationship of those families to each other. And when I started working on the project, a good friend of mine had a book that was written by a professor that was helping the Navajo Nation with their land claim settlement against the United States. And part of that history was of the Chaco Navajo. in the attempt that trying to hold on to Navajo land, because the original treaty that was made that really established the Navajo tribal government only identified original small portion of where Navajo people lived. It didn't include a lot of spaces like lands that were around the San Juan River, Farmington, when the Navajo people were moved out. In that interim, a lot of white settlers came back in into that area. So part of the land allotment effort was to try to build on reclaiming Navajo land. You know, but there's different ideas. In the past, that he said, well, land allotment was just another way of getting Indians off the reservation, because instead of having them own, be part of a whole reservation, you divide it up, send them out, and they, you know, are on their own. But this was a different case with the land allotment in Eastern Navajo. And again, people talk all the time about, you know, how tribal communities are not able to progress and grow, that they're kind of lagging behind or behind the times. You have to realize this is a map like in the 1860s. And the East Coast, you know, had about 200 more years of development, and development of infrastructure, different kind of institutions. And as you moved west or removed the Indian population, it's like almost not starting over, but trying to reclaim, okay, your lifestyle. And it's just not even 200 years that we're building those institutions. You know, whether it's education, healthcare, or even our own economy. But real briefly, again, one of the things I tried to do over at Fort Sumner was to kind of follow this history. So 1968, 150 years ago almost. And this kind of gives you an idea. But 40 square miles of land was set aside. Mescaleros were there first. Then later came Navajo families. And here was the Pecos River. So the travel people took was along the rivers. And this shows the original military barracks, headquarters, storage facilities. And here is remaining parts of that military facilities up here. But the state of New Mexico withdrew this land here, for the original visitor center was here. And then the Pecos River. This was a drawing that was done by John Paul Jones, Cherokee landscape architect. And I had the chance to work with him on a number of other projects. But he came out and helped us here with his landscape design. And coming up with the different concepts and ideas about landmarks, sight lines, and the original Vasco Redondo, meaning circular growth of trees, than some of the cottonwood trees that were there and by Pecos River. And this is the original visitor center. And so again, taking these sketches and drawings, you know, and taking it back to the community and talking about them. You know, we visit the Mescalero. The Mescalero weren't really interested in the project. Originally, going back to that map, this was Mescalero homeland in that area. And they felt indifferent about the project, that there was no surrender, no incarceration, and they left. So, but at the same time, you know, historically, landscape-wise, landmass, it was theirs. But our whole idea, okay, was the landscape would be the memorial. And we haven't gotten enough money from the state yet to really finish out the landscape. But the whole concept was that this would be the memorial, and there's still building blocks that we have to finish out. The local Fort Sumner community also uses that space, you know, for a lot of their projects and a lot of their community gatherings. And that whole idea was that this would be a opportunity, okay, for Fort Sumner community to meet and work with Navajo Nation and with the Mescalero Apache Nation. We're still working on that. Still got a lot of projects to do together. But what my office, what my fellow Navajo professionals, when we first thought about this was, I don't have a picture of it, but one of the first shelters that the Navajo people built there in Fort Sumner was from what wood that they were able to gather from the river and use that to build with. So this form was part of that structure. Now we felt was our interpretation of those early shelters that were built there. And like I said, one of the things that we wanted to do was to cross the river is to restore that landscape so that the earlier natural vegetation would come back, the animals, the river would be the source, you know, of restoring that landscape. And there would be walkways and trails in that environment. So again, it wasn't about the building as much as the landscape. And here we thought, well, as you park your car and enter and you approach, we had some ideas about the Navajo plans with the markings here. And going on, even with the mescaleros. So those were all our ideas about that project there. But this is that center that we're starting to try to build that landscape on. And that was opened in 2005. And Joe Shirley was the president at that time. But we started on that project when Peterson saw Kelsey Begay was there. And now we're still working on it. So that's kind of the opportunities I've had being an architect and being a businessman as well. Because I had to become a businessman to be able to afford to be an architect. Okay. But that's what I've been doing. And I think now I want to try something else. I'm not sure what that is going to be. 35 plus years is a long time to work with architecture, especially you're fighting contractors all the time, you're fighting owners, you're fighting the budget, you're fighting time, it wears on you. But it gives me a lot of freedom. So any questions? I gave the same kind of presentation to the students today earlier, but I try to take it from the perspective of giving them information about the challenges I had to go through to become an architect. You know, not only, you know, coming and publicly speaking, but also competing and at the same time try to pay my bills and pay my employees.
How much time do you put aside researching a place before you determine the design? Is there an average time?
Well, it all depends on the project. We do everything from housing to child care, to health centers, to retail stores, to cultural centers. Some projects don't take as long for us to understand the environment, the land, the utilities, the soil, the orientation where the sun, where the wind patterns are coming from. We do that all part up front, and sometimes it takes us a couple of weeks to 2 months to 6 months. But when you take on a project like a cultural center, you have to have community meetings. And like in Tohono O'odham, that reservation is almost the size of the Navajo reservation. And they're the same way. You have villages on the east side, the west side, the north, south, and you have to visit all of those communities. And you have to build consensus in those projects. So you spend a lot of time having people talk to themselves to agree upon an idea, and that takes time. And like the Tohono O'odham nursing home project, it took us a whole year to put the plans together. And probably 6 months was the pre-planning. And then the National Museum for the American Indian, my part was going out to the different parts of the U.S. and talking to the different Indian communities about what the project was going to be. And I didn't have a chance to go back after the design was done, because my upfront part was to help them come up with a concept, meaning come up with an idea that they would use to build and design around. That was my job.
It seems like in order to visit these communities and to come up with some of the plans, you have to know the right questions to ask.
Right.
So how do you learn how to ask the right questions?
Trial and error. Initially, when I visit some of the Indian communities, like I went up to Vancouver, British Columbia, and we had kind of like an idea about the form and the shape. Right away, the people said, "You're from the Southwest, okay? You're bringing us a Southwest design." I said, "No, I'm not. It's not a Southwest design, because we all share, we all have common experiences. We all have common values. We all have common insights to who we are. And it's just changed by the location and the environment." You know, you can talk to people up in North Dakota about how they navigate the stars, and then how they organize their landmarks by the stars, and the mountains and the buttes that they have is related to those stars. It's the same kind of ideas here in the Southwest as in the Northwest, but just a different environment, a different material type. So that's how, what I tried, I don't have a picture of it, but what we did is we did like a matrix. All the Western community hemispheres, South America, Middle America, North America, we had images, okay, of all the different building forms, the igloo, the plank houses, the mud houses, and all down the line down to South America. Then we had another column that showed significant ceremonial grounds. Whether it's a plaza, whether it's a circle up in Montana, we identified and we tried to identify a common thread through all of these different cultures. And that cultural resource center was kind of like accumulation of that. Because you go down South America, that spiral is, you can identify in some of their plaza designs, and some of their clothing that they weave for themselves. You saw that same thing, you know, in the Northwest, you know, whether it was because they seen a shape like that in a bird and its feathers with its wings, how it would look. And so a lot of that was kind of like common elements. And that's how we try to build consensus, that we're all part of the same community.
I had a question going back to the way you designed your buildings and using nature. I was fascinated with the Smithsonian Institute design that you used. It reminds me of the golden ratio that's found in nature, and I found it pretty fascinating that you'd use that design.
Yeah.
And the golden spiral from the Smithsonian.
It's true. The
Myself, I belong to an organization called the American Indian Council of Architects and Engineers, and it's a professional group, all native companies, architects and engineers. We have university professors that are part of the membership. We have contractors. But we as a group across the country, when the project first came out, there's a lot of competition from firms all over the U.S. And instead of, like myself, teaming up with one company, we decided to band as a group, and we as a group offered our association to all of the different companies that were willing to accept us, be on their team. So we were like on 7 different teams out of 20 that submitted proposals to the Smithsonian. And then we were like on 4 the finalists. Our group, our team, was part of that. And one of our logo design, it was just, like you were saying, but it was feathers, circular. And when we went in Manhattan and starting with that design, you know, we were thinking like it was 2 separate forces coming and trying to twist and dominate. But we said, no, we have to unify. And that's where that compromise, so to speak, came out. I don't have those pictures with me, but we show a lot of different illustrations. Like we had 2 different triangles coming onto the site. We overlaid it on the landscape, how the topography of the landscape was, and we had that kind of situate the building. You can't really see it, but we were trying to bring back the vegetation to this area. One of the projects I did with the Salt River Pima, their land is just east of Scottsdale, and at the time, the encroachment of development was just on their west and on their north. But today, when you go out there, they're being encroached from the south and from the east. But they have the Salt River going right through their land. And they still have some limited farming, but their irrigation system, they were the first ones that had the concept of irrigation in the Phoenix Valley at that time, you know, before there was any white settlers coming through that area. And their irrigation system was like blood veins. You know, you have a main vein, and then you have vessels coming off of it. And that's how the irrigation system worked. And one of the designs that we worked on for the museum was based upon that irrigation system. I didn't know it, but they said, well, they had some kind of instrument that they use to identify how the grades would change in the landscape so that they knew which way to route the streams and their channels. I never could find that, but a lot of community members had that oral history about seeing that. But that's what we had in our design, was an outdoor sculpture. A lot of times, a lot of architects, myself included, we have a lot of unbuilt projects. You know, we've done like a lot of good designs on a lot of different projects, but there's just no money, or there's politics involved.
For your presentation, I really enjoyed the cultural aspect of the input at the very beginning and throughout the entire process. But how has architectural design changed over time since you started working? Has it changed much from the 1970s through 80s as far as advances and also the introduction of technology that have caused an influence among, especially our Navajo youth and people, as we lose and move further and further away from speaking Navajo, and also not listening to the elders' teachings and the stories.
Yeah.
But the young people do get a chance to see that as a symbol, and they see it, and they visit these places, and they hear the stories, which I think is very important. And the second part, cultural restrictions. You ever come across a lot of quite a bit of that as well, such as pertaining to symbols and in a sacred context?
Okay. From my experience of work, I grew up on a drafting board, pencil, you know, parallel bar, triangle, and make circles by hand. That was my tools, okay, for architecture. But freehand was also the initial vision of what you were trying to express in the building form. So the technology has really changed in architecture. And the change has been rapid. It's like what you're saying, you know. A small square, the next square above it isn't larger. The next square above it is more larger. And that's the way kind of like life is sometimes. It just multiplies its magnitude. Twice what it was before in architecture is kind of similar to that. But there's also a change in the business environment. Because usually the business environment has the cash to put up to pay for the architecture. So business has had a lot of influence on architecture 20 years ago. And then when I was starting out, it seems like the lifestyle would go in cycles. You know, early on with Little Big Man, Dustin Hoffman, that was one of the first big movies to the whole United States that people had a chance to see Indian people in a different environment, in a different context. And then you have Dances with Wolves, another big public exposure. And it seemed like the cycle would go in 20 years or 30 years, so forth. And that's the way Native American architecture has been too. There was a lot of interest, a lot of people want to see what is Native American architecture. So that was also happening at the same time. But you're right, you know, there's a lot of changes that are happening that we're losing the context and the value connected to that context that we don't pass on from generation to generation. And I don't know how to handle that. But with architecture, you try to provide that context that certain events or certain kinds of visions are reinforced by those values. So that's what I really started kind of working on, was understanding our values and then try to reinforce through architecture those values. But the other thing too, I mean, right, you know, there's certain traditional symbolism, traditional spaces that we have a hard time deciding if we want to share that outside the tribal community. And oftentimes I don't want to go down that road. I'll avoid it. Like even like when casinos came up, I mean, casinos were a good thing for Indian people because it generated revenue, generated money. And most often it was from non-natives where that cash flow was coming from. You know, back to the res, to the Indian communities. But as you're seeing it, casinos, people were designing casinos with a lot of Indian symbolism. You know, like I went down to Gila River, and one of the casinos I was going to, they had pottery sitting alongside the walkway. And hearing some of the women talk about the patterns and the pottery that they designed, the meaning to them, to me, you know, that was disrespectful to put pottery down leading into the casino. There's other things too. You go around a lot of tribal casinos. Most of them are sensitive to that and try not to, you know, be disrespectful. But sometimes it's a battle because the leadership, when I first started architecture, a lot of tribal communities were mostly elders. And then today, it's more the middle age, and the middle age is more professional, and their attitude is more like, well, what is the cost? How much time is it going to take? You know, what benefits do we have from this effort? So, elders were talking about, you know, family, talking about preserving, protecting the natural resources that they had. Those were kind of like the values that they had to make the decision. But nowadays, it's totally different. You know, unfortunately, that's why I see a lot of tribal government. And it's hard to get them back to thinking about reinvesting into their own values. but that's what we do. Try to do anyway. But you know, again, it takes a lot of resources from the community to do a good job.
Having done this for 25 years and learning a lot about the Native American across the United States, have you ever come to a place where you just kind of have this profound idea for that particular space?
Not too often, okay? But when the opportunity comes, it's usually... like I have two daughters, both of them are into art. One's an art teacher, and the other one is just studying art. And they always question me about the things that I do, and they leave some of the drawings that we used to do. They were there in my office, and they were seeing the things that we were doing. They liked the colors, they liked the shapes, the forms, all that kind of stuff, all that activity. And they'd come up with an idea, well, why don't you create a swimming pool where people can live in. And you know, so you know, you kind of have to stop and like, think about it, that every once in a while you'll hear someone say something about their life or their space or whatever, and then right away an idea comes in. And usually it's when I hear that, that's when it comes up. I never had a chance where somebody just told me, well, here, do what you want to do and design something. You know, I've never had that opportunity.
So we have food out there. I'm thinking maybe you could adjourn out there and if anybody has questions, maybe they can talk to you. But,
yeah.